A quick word from our sponsor, Freed. We all want a more efficient workflow, and Freed is an AI scribe that helps with just that. Freed AI not only listens, it transcribes and writes your medical documentation for you. And yes, it's HIPAA compliant. I use it regularly when I'm on service, and I have to say, Freed is a really intuitive interface, so it really seamlessly integrated into my daily workflow and routine. I think we all have our own particular way we like to write notes, and so what's great about Freed is that it not only listens, but it also understands and adapts to your unique style over time. So the sooner you start with Freed, the easier that your day could possibly be. Give it a try and see if an AI scribe fits into your workflow. You can use the code CORE50 to get $50 off your first month of Freed. Again, use the code CORE50 to get $50 off your first month of Freed. And with that, let's get into this episode.
Welcome to the Core IM 5 Pearls podcast, bringing you high-yield, evidence-based pearls. Today, we're going to talk all things constipation and constipation meds. I'm Dr. Shreya Trivedi, and I'm joined by...
Hi, I'm Dr. Kalila Pice, an internal medicine resident at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. And it's an interesting topic because I can't say that there's one particular specialty that owns constipation treatment. Is it GI? Is it the internist who treats it every day? Is it the nurses who are administering these bowel regimens, PRN, and giving the enemas?
Okay.
Or is it the pharmacist on the team?
Yeah. So we actually sat down with all of them, and why don't we let them introduce themselves?
My name is Alan Lee. I'm an assistant professor in the Division of GI at the University of Michigan.
I'm Taylor Thompson. I'm currently a clinical assistant professor at West Virginia University School of Pharmacy and School of Medicine. I practice in outpatient family medicine within the family medicine residency.
My name is Jack Sibilia. I'm a registered nurse. I'm the unit-based educator there.
So let's get into it. Test yourself by pausing after each of the 5 questions.
Remember, the more you test yourself, the deeper your learning gains.
Pearl 1, high-yield reversible causes of constipation. What are some of the common intervenable causes for constipation?
Pearl 2. Fiber, hydration, and bulk-forming laxatives. Which type of fiber is more helpful for constipation? And is hydration really better?
Pearl 3, osmotic and stimulant laxatives. What makes you pick one versus the other?
Pearl 4. Suppositories and enemas. What are the differences between suppositories and enemas?
Pearl 5, opioid-induced constipation. What are some of the best practices when it comes to opioid-induced constipation?
I think the first big question I had was, how do we even define constipation? Like, is there a specific number of bowel movements per day? Is it when the stool is getting hardened, or is it because of increased straining?
Yeah, all good questions. And I think there's so much there. I think the textbook definition is it's abnormal for someone to have 3 bowel movements or fewer in a week. But practically speaking, I think it honestly comes down to what is normal for a patient. And I think either way, when we see someone who has it, it's really about us putting our investigative hat on to rule out if there's any secondary causes at play. They're so common. Kalila, why don't you tell our listeners the mnemonic that you actually made up to help bucket these different causes?
I would love to. So to try to keep all of these things that contribute to constipation straight in my head, I came up with the mnemonic LMNOP, which stands for lifestyle, metabolic, neurologic, obstructive, and pharmacologic.
Nice. And we'll go through them kind of in super speed, but I think it's so valuable to review, especially if you do catch a secondary cause, we might not have to reach for some of the medications we're going to talk about later in Pearl 3 and 4. So first up, L for lifestyle. What should we dig into here?
So for lifestyle, I'm thinking about if patients are moving or eating enough. This is especially true in our patients that are more bedbound or have low fiber diets.
With constipation, I personally like to do more of a less is more initially, like try the simple things, getting them up, walking, get them eating, get them drinking and stuff like that. I have seen a lot of the time, like people with just getting up and moving, you start to see something, like even if it's more like it starts off small and then it starts going gradually until the point where they're starting to have more regular bowel movements.
I do love when that is the only thing that does a trick, but I would be remiss to say, as an internist, I'm always thinking about like hashtag multifactorial contributors. And so I'm always thinking about other things going on, especially metabolic insults. So let's dig into the M of that mnemonic metabolic.
So when I'm admitting someone for constipation, I'm keeping a close eye on three electrolytes: calcium, potassium, and magnesium. So with calcium, I know that elevated calcium levels affect the nervous system and the smooth muscle. So what happens in the gut? Hypercalcemia slows things down.
Right. And I think there's one more mechanism that with calcium at play. I remember one time having a patient with hyperparathyroidism and elevated calcium levels, and she was just peeing out a ton and getting more dehydrated in this vicious constipation cycle. Turns out high calcium levels impair the kidney's ability to concentrate urine, hence being all peed out. So that dehydration definitely didn't help that constipation bit.
And then when we think about potassium and magnesium, I'm looking for those levels that are appreciably low in a patient with constipation. Low potassium can mess up our GI smooth muscle function, and then low magnesium can cause muscle spasms.
No fun. I think the other important metabolic insult to keep in mind is thyroid, especially when we see a TSH that's greater than 10, that the hypothyroidism might be at play.
Okay, let's move on to the N in the mnemonic for neurologic disorder. So when you're taking care of a patient with certain disorders like MS, Parkinson's, dementia, or spinal cord dysfunction, we need to make sure that they have a strong bowel regimen from the get-go. That's because these patients are at a higher risk of constipation.
Okay. And the O in the mnemonic is O for obstruction, right? And things that may be a little bit more obvious, like if they have colon cancer, fissures, strictures, that will definitely impact some of that stool moving forward.
And finally, the one I think we think about a lot in internal medicine is the P for pharmacologic.
So tricyclic antidepressants, antispasmodics, these are some of the medications that we commonly will see. Calcium channel blockers are another common class of medications. Patients who are on antipsychotics have a lot of constipation. And that actually is a very tough group of patients to manage. And then I think one of the medication classes that we're seeing more and more as being associated with constipation are these GLP-1 analogs that people are using for diabetes as well as the treatment of obesity.
Yes, I do have to say the pharmacological bucket is my favorite one. And I love thinking about, oh, is it the nifedipine or the verapamil that might be playing a role? And thinking, is there something else I could transition them to, or maybe a lower dose might do it? I really appreciate hearing from our pharmacist discussant about even over-the-counter meds that might be contributing to constipation.
There are actually a lot of over-the-counter things that can cause constipation that might not be on the med list in the chart. So asking about like aluminum-containing drugs like antacids, calcium supplements like a lot of antacids, so Tums, depending on what kind of Tums they're taking, those things can cause constipation. And we might not even know that patients are taking a ton of Tums at home. So asking about that. Over-the-counter iron supplements can cause a lot of constipation. Over-the-counter antihistamines, especially things like Benadryl, that can cause constipation. Anything anticholinergic.
Okay, that is really humbling and honestly has motivated me to do a better job of asking my patients about their use of over-the-counter medications, especially ones like Tums, iron supplements, or Benadryl.
Yeah, and since we came to the end of the mnemonic, and just to say it out loud, if we don't find a secondary cause for the constipation, we do have to think about if primary or idiopathic constipation might be at play. This is basically due to pelvic outlet obstruction or slow transit, but that's beyond the scope of today's episode.
Right. So to summarize, what I'm taking away from this pearl is that when I'm seeing a patient with constipation, I should think through the helpful mnemonic LMNOP for secondary causes. L for lifestyle, asking about how much they've been moving, how much water they've been drinking, and trying to get a sense of how much fiber they're taking in. M for metabolic, so looking at high calcium or low magnesium and low potassium levels, or a high TSH that could be contributing. N for neurologic, O for obstruction, and P, everyone's favorite, for pharmacologic.
Yeah, I'm really looking at that med rec to see if the timeline for when they started either an antipsychotic, antidepressant, particular calcium channel blockers, antispasmodics, or opioids might be at play, and then to ask them also about over-the-counter meds like Tums or iron supplements, if that might be impacting things. So let's say there may or may not be a clear offending cause. Our patients still need relief. So let's get into the different constipation treatments and start off with some of the easier or more first-line things like fiber, dig into hydration more, and then bulk-forming laxatives.
Yeah, I don't know about you, Shreya, but I spend a lot of time telling my patients to increase their fiber intake.
Yeah, same. Especially if the constipation's like mild or moderate, they don't have a lot of symptoms. Sure, let's do a trial of fiber supplementation. Psyllium, methylcellulose, it's low risk, low cost, easily accessible, a win to try.
Yeah, and it's really great when it works. The way that it works is basically forming a gel-like matrix around the stool. This bulks up and softens the stool because it increases stool weight and water retention.
Great. So psyllium and methylcellulose basically affect the stool only and have no effect on the actual colon.
There's been a number of systematic reviews and meta-analyses that have shown benefit with fiber for the treatment of chronic idiopathic constipation. I think one thing to realize is that most of these meta-analyses have shown benefits specifically for soluble fiber, and that includes things like psyllium, but not necessarily with insoluble fiber like bran.
So not all fiber supplementation is the same, huh? So insoluble fibers like wheat bran might actually make constipation worse, and we really want to reach for the more soluble fibers like psyllium or my favorite, oats.
Yeah, and when counseling patients to take more fiber, I actually did not realize this until doing some research for this podcast, but there's an FDA recommendation to take psyllium 2 hours before or after other medications, and that's to avoid any med interactions.
The one thing with the fiber agents like psyllium and methylcellulose is they might reduce absorption of some of your other medications. So for example, if you're on Synthroid, for example, and you're also taking fiber, there may be recommendations to separate the fiber from other medications.
In addition to the thyroid medication our pharmacist just mentioned, fiber binds to other meds like calcium and antacids and magnesium and zinc. So really, maybe just advise patients to take Synthroid first thing in the morning and then fiber a few hours apart from other supplements.
The other things that I'll tell patients when I start them on fiber is that fiber can worsen GI symptoms, especially as they're ramping up, particularly symptoms like bloating and abdominal pain. So my general advice when I start patients on fiber is to start low. So you know, they could start at like 3 to 4 grams of fiber per day and then increase their dose slowly over time for a goal of about 20 to 30 grams of fiber per day. And this total includes both dietary as well as supplemental fiber intake. And this may take weeks for patients to get up to that goal.
Yes. So start slow. And I also learned another lesson about fiber the hard way. When I was pregnant for the first time, and I think a bit of TMI here, I actually started taking psyllium prophylactically because I thought, oh, I've heard so many stories about how constipation is just worse in pregnancy, so let me try to beat it. But actually, it got so much worse and actually created a problem I didn't even have, all because I didn't increase my fluid intake with that extra fiber.
Oh, no. And here you were thinking you were getting extra credit for staying ahead of the problem, but nope.
So no good deed goes unpunished.
Speaking of the fluids, I know we counsel patients on staying hydrated, which is honestly a personal challenge for me. But how much water is really needed to improve constipation?
My general approach to hydration, I think this is a reasonable initial recommendation, especially in patients who aren't consuming adequate amounts of water. So that's about 1.5 to 2 liters per day. But in patients who are already consuming adequate amounts of hydration, it's probably not going to be a huge benefit in increasing this for patients who have chronic constipation.
Yeah, so there was this study in 1990, which compared constipation in healthy males based on fluid intake. It showed that those who only took 500 cc's of liquid were, of course, constipated, but those who took 2.5 liters really didn't have more improvement in their constipation with more water intake.
Oh, okay. So maybe the way to think about it is if you've already reached 2 liters of water a day, you've removed hydration from being a contributor to that constipation, and we should really look for other reasons.
So that's fluids. I've also heard certain fruits and vegetables can prevent constipation. I wonder if there's any evidence to it, and if so, what are the high-yield ones to tell patients to order for their lunch?
Or dinner.
Or dinner.
Dried plums or prunes appear to be more effective for reducing constipation than psyllium in adults with mild to moderate constipation. And then kiwi fruit may slightly increase stool frequency compared to psyllium in adults with chronic constipation.
All right, prunes and kiwi it is. Let's summarize this, Pearl. We want to try to emphasize to our patients to take soluble fiber supplementation for constipation like psyllium or methylcellulose or oats as opposed to insoluble fibers like wheat bran.
And when I prescribe fiber supplementation for patients, I give them a heads up about possible bloating and abdominal pain. I tell them to take the fiber a few hours apart from other medications like Synthroid or mineral supplements like zinc and calcium.
And then, of course, what I learned the hard way is encourage that hydration, right? And then patients who might already be adequately hydrated, say 2 liters or above of water, might not get any extra relief. And then, of course, I do love telling my patients to order oatmeal in the morning and some prunes and kiwis for lunch from the cafeteria. Okay, so say fiber supplementation, hydration, all the good things aren't really working. This is when I start thinking about medications like laxatives. I think most people would break it down to osmotic laxatives versus stimulant laxatives.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty common way of separating them out. So it's helpful to know which ones fall into which bucket.
Yeah, I think it is important to keep which meds fall into which bucket straight, because if we don't, our patients might end up on a bowel regimen where they're all on medications with the same exact mechanism.
Yeah, I have definitely seen those med recs where someone is on these quote-unquote aggressive bowel regimens, but it's really all just osmotic laxatives over and over again and no other medication with another mode of action.
That would really suck if they're also volume down and like on 3 different osmotic laxatives. I just have to say out loud, like there's no clear evidence that this approach is better than that approach. But I think theoretically, to me, it makes sense if one agent is maxed out. Let's try a medication in another category to see if that would help move things forward.
So to try to keep them all straight, we came up with a mnemonic for osmotic laxatives. And that mnemonic is pretty magical liquid. P in pretty is for polyethylene glycol. M in magical is for magnesium-based meds, and L in liquid is for lactulose. And hopefully just the idea of pretty magical liquid helps us remember that it is a magical liquid that contains osmotically active molecules drawing fluid into the lumen.
Right. And then for the stimulant laxatives, we got spicy bowel movers. S in spicy for senna and B in bowel for bisacoidal. And movers to hopefully help you remember that senna and bisacoidal work directly to stimulate the colonic neurons to move the colon.
Okay, now that we know which ones fall into which bucket, let's get into the nuances about each of the laxatives and their time of onset, side effects, and general patient tolerance.
Okay, so let's get started with our osmotic laxatives. So we already learned that osmotic laxatives is polyethylene glycol, lactulose, magnesium citrate, magnesium oxide, and it works by drawing fluid into the bowel through osmosis.
You know what's interesting? All of these osmotic laxatives, so polyethylene glycol, lactulose, mag oxide, or mag citrate, they all work in similar ways, but have very different onsets of action.
So Miralax is great, right? It's safe for most people, but if you need something quicker, you know, that's going to take up 72 hours.
Yeah, I guess the amount of polyethylene glycol in a typical Miralax can take up to 3 days to work. And it's funny because if I reflect on all the times I like up someone's bowel regimen and, you know, increase the Miralax and expected, oh, they're going to have bowel movement later this afternoon, just might have not made sense because it could definitely take longer.
Yeah, I have definitely fallen into that exact same trap. And looking into it, lactulose actually works a little faster, so 24 to 48 hours. And then magnesium citrate is actually cited to work even faster, so between 30 to 6 hours. And then its cousin, mag oxide, is a little bit less bioavailable than the mag citrate, but it's still cited to work pretty fast, so 3 to 6 hours.
Yeah, I'm so glad we're bringing this up because sometimes I'm not sure which bowel regimen to reach for first. And like, yeah, let's just do Miralax because that's the practice pattern that's been passed on. But maybe another way to think about it is if I want someone to have a bowel movement on the faster side, maybe to reach for the magnesium oxide or the magnesium citrate or even lactulose.
But this is where side effects could be your tiebreaker and weighing which ones have more or less side effects for our patients.
Lactulose has more bloating. It has more flatulence. Our magnesium products can cause those electrolyte abnormalities. So avoiding those in patients with kidney dysfunction or anyone at risk of electrolyte abnormalities.
Okay, so to break that down, it's probably best to avoid lactulose in patients who may already have abdominal pain, bloating, or are already gassy. And to cement why that side effect is, if we think about what lactulose is, it's a synthetic disaccharide, right? It's minimally absorbed. So when it passes down our gut, it's our gut bacteria that ferments it and produces a nasty gas like methane and some other things that causes all these side effects. Interestingly, though, we often use lactulose in hepatic encephalopathy. Why? Because that gas is really helpful because it brings a lower pH, that the gas traps ammonia in the gut, which is, I think, just really cool to think about.
Yeah, that's definitely pretty cool. And when we think about the magnesium side effects, many will say to avoid mag supplementation in patients with renal dysfunction. The thought is that impaired renal systems may not be able to tolerate the excess mag. But we looked into it and it's actually controversial. More recent studies and thinking is that giving magnesium supplementation can be done safely, but with routine monitoring of magnesium levels.
And then just one last thing to close out the osmotic laxative part is something that blew my mind. I was ordering MoviPrep and Go Lightly for a patient before a colonoscopy, and I realized it said PEG 3350 as a generic. And I was like, wait. And it finally hit me after all these years of ordering that, wait, MoviPrep is just a larger volume of polyethylene glycol, aka PEG. Gosh.
Go Lightly is essentially PEG with electrolytes, just in a larger volume and given over a shorter amount of time. And so basically, we're just trying to purge patients of their stool burden and trying to relieve their symptoms in a shorter amount of time. I typically wouldn't give Go Lightly in patients who are just having kind of run-of-the-mill constipation. So this is only in patients who are having more kind of moderate to severe type symptoms.
Yeah, the first time I saw Go Lightly used for severe constipation, I thought, whoa, I cannot believe that I didn't think about this before. I mean, we use it to clean out the bowels before colonoscopies, so why not use it when the team feels really stuck that nothing's moving? Pun intended.
Yes, nice. All right, with that, let's transition to stimulant laxatives. We already learned spicy bowel movers, aka Senna, Bisquitol.
And just to remind everyone, Senna and Bisquitol have no effect on the actual stool the way that psyllium does. Instead, these medications work on the colonic neurons to stimulate them.
All right. One of my favorite teaching points is to ask my team, hey, do you know why Senna is dosed at nighttime?
Yeah, does it have something to do with how Senna is processed at night?
Yeah, so I wondered this too, and turns out that the onset of Senna takes 6 to 12 hours to work. So people would like to tell their patients, like, okay, take it at nighttime, it'll take effect overnight, and then the patient would have their first bowel movement in the morning. And so then after learning this, I felt relieved to tell my patients, hey, you can actually take the Senna whenever you want, whatever makes you remember to take it, unless you feel very strong about having the bowel movement early in the morning, then sure, take it at nighttime.
Okay, wow, that makes so much more sense. And it's good to know where the epic default of Senna at 2100 comes from.
Right?
The one thing I was thinking about is how often I see Senna dosed as a daily medication. But looking into the literature, it has really been tested more as a rescue laxative.
I think of Bisquitol and Senna as like your rescue laxative. And the reason for that is use for a long period of time, so beyond like 4 weeks, there's not really data for long-term efficacy, and efficacy of these agents will actually decrease over time if you use them chronically every single day. In my practice, I have seen you can go up to like 2 tablets twice a day, so 17.2 in the morning, 17.2 in the evening, and as you go up on the dose, I think that it tends to work better. We use 4 tablets a day, so there's really not a ton of data for how to dose Senna, but commonly, you'll see even 4 tablets twice a day.
Okay. So say we're going up on the Senna once a day, twice a day. What are the side effects we should be looking out for?
I know there used to be this concern or fear that chronic use of stimulant laxatives may damage the enteric nervous system or patients may get dependent on these, but that's largely been shown to be false. For the stimulant laxatives, really abdominal cramping and pain are the side effects that I counsel patients about. Certainly can cause diarrhea as well.
I really love talking to Jack because I especially appreciated hearing what our nursing colleagues had to say about their experience administering Senna at the bedside.
Senna, you can get it as a liquid. It comes in a little Dixie cup type thing. It's 8.6 milliliters or something like that. Very easy because you can mix it in with a lot of meds. So a lot of our confused patients or stuff like you have a patient with dementia, some sort of encephalopathy, whatever. will crush a lot of the meds and give it with ice cream. You can relatively give it and it will go unnoticed. The second you add Senna to that mix, the ice cream becomes a hint of brown and it tastes gritty and like very like much like dirt. So it's always tricky once you start adding Senna into that mix because it's like they're going to know. It's like, this is the worst ice cream I've ever tasted. I'm like, oh, yeah, sorry. Must be old. It's our old brown ice cream that we have in the back.
Oh, man. Round of applause to the nurses and like the tricks that they have to pull with certain patients to get them to take their meds. And I think with that, why don't we summarize all good things on osmotic and stimulant laxatives. So we learned osmotic laxatives work by pulling water through osmosis into the colon. And it's really pretty magical liquids, things like polyethylene glycol, MAC supplements, and lactulose. And then for the stimulant laxatives, they work by stimulating the colonic wall to move. Remember spicy bowel movers for Senna and bisacoidal.
And when thinking about which osmotic laxatives to use, keep in mind that Miralax is generally safe and well tolerated, but it may take up to 72 hours to work. So we may consider some of our other osmotic laxatives like magnesium oxide or magnesium citrate if we want a faster onset of action. And in terms of stimulant laxatives, Senna and bisacodyl have a faster onset of action than Miralax does, but it has only been studied as a rescue agent for up to 4 weeks. So anything outside of that just hasn't been studied.
I am so excited to have Echo Core 500 Digital Stethoscope as a sponsor. I actually learned about them accidentally a year or so ago when I'd forgotten my stethoscope and my resident let me borrow his, and I just was like, wow, I've never heard heart sounds or lung sounds this clearly. You just get this extra level of confidence for those moments where you're asking, was that faint crackles? Was that an S3 gallop? And so that's because Echo's digital stethoscope amplifies sounds 40x, and then on top of that, it has noise cancellation so you can really hear with precision in a noisy ED or with a really loud roommate or other environments. Echo AI is also built in and helps you detect murmurs and AFib earlier. A cool thing also is that you can record that heart sound that you heard, share it later with your team, or a case presentation. And then you can really trust the diagnostic accuracy. It's backed by 4 million heart sounds and 8 FDA clearances for the devices and the AI algorithms. So those who use Echo are twice as likely to catch heart disease. What I think is neat is that Echo 500 isn't just the digital stethoscope. You can actually also get an EKG tracing right on the app when you place an Echo 500 on a patient's chest. So no more waiting around trying to trace down the EKG machine on the floor. I trust Echo so much that I work with a team to create a special offer just for our listeners. Right now, you can get $50 off plus a free customizable chest piece cover at echohealth.com/corium. Your purchase will be HSA and FSA eligible and may also qualify for CME reimbursement. Plus, Echo guarantees you're going to detect heart and lung sounds more confidently. And if you don't, you can return it with a full refund. Go to echohealth.com/corium for $50 off plus a free chest cover. That's ekohealth.com/corium. And with that, let's get back into the episode. Here at Corium, we're talking about the real things that can help anyone who works in healthcare. And today we're talking about how the scrubs you wear, they can make a difference. I remember the first time I saw one of my colleagues walking into a sign-up room looking way more put together after a night shift. And I knew right then and there, they were wearing FIGS. FIGS scrubs is made specifically for us doctors, residents, students, healthcare professionals who are putting in long hours and really need gear that can keep up and perform on our level. We have so much going on in any shift, right? Scrubs are the last thing we want to be thinking about. And that's why FIGS is great in that they're lightweight, stretchy, breathable. They have all the small touches that have made me a true convert. They're clean, they're modern, super functional, tons of pockets that I love for all the snacks, zippers that don't snag, and antimicrobial fabric to stay healthy while working. You deserve better scrubs. You deserve FIGS. So head over to FIGS.com and enter FIGSRX at the checkout for 15% off your first purchase. That's FIGS.com, promo code FIGSRX for 15% off your first purchase. And with that, let's head back to the episode.
Now on to suppositories and enemas, maybe my favorite section because I learned a ton here.
Okay, yeah, same. And if I'm going to be honest, if you had asked me the difference between a suppository and an enema before making this episode, I would not have been able to answer. So I really appreciated Jack's vivid description of the two, especially since he sees it all the time as a bedside nurse.
So with the suppository, you're pretty much dealing with a medication that's going in the rectum. We call it torpedoes. It looks like they're these small cylindrical white it looks almost like a crayon type medication. They're very slippery. They react a lot to body heat. So you got, once you take them out, you really got to be relatively quick to get them in there. But it's pretty much like a torpedo of medication that goes out the patient's rectum, for lack of a better description, is what it looks like. With an enema, it's more of we're instilling water into the rectum to help kind of loosen up the stool.
Okay, so the teaching point is that a suppository is a dissolvable solid tablet that is placed into the patient's rectum versus an enema, which is an instillation of fluid into the patient's rectum.
And I think like how Jack described it is kind of a rule of thumb because there's just so many different types out there. I think the other thing to keep in mind is what a patient may tolerate. Like, is someone who is delirious and not able to follow instructions, are they really going to be able to hold something in their rectum for 15 minutes?
But what I struggle with is knowing which suppository or enema to use in the first place and what's the difference between them. There are so many out there. We have Fleet enemas, water enemas, mineral oil enemas, lactulose enemas, even soap sud enemas.
Yeah. One day I went down this crazy deep dive in this very evidence-free zone of enemas and suppositories. I didn't understand. I'm like, why was GI recommending soap suds and mineral oil enema for this patient with severe constipation, but then Fleet enema for this other person? I'm like, maybe worthwhile to dive into this evidence-free zone and try to clarify some of the things up.
Yeah, let's get into it. And maybe one way to ground us is the mechanism. And then from here, it might be easier to think about our patients and what they may be able to tolerate best.
Yeah, I agree. Let's start with mineral oil enemas. Mineral oil enemas basically work by lubricating the colon.
Interesting. So mineral oil enemas are like greasing the tracks for the poop train, which takes time.
Yes, right? And then once I learned it, I was like, oh, duh, it's an oil. So mineral oil enema basically works by coating the stool and the colonic wall to help things slide out a little bit easier.
Mineral oil enemas are probably a safer option compared to some of our other enema options. I will say the mineral oil enema is a retention enema, which requires patients to like hold it or retain the fluid for a bit so the enema has time to work.
Okay, so it may take some time to work, but what's not to love about a little bit of extra lubrication here and there?
Agreed. Now, onto Fleet enemas, aka sodium phosphate enemas.
Yeah, so what are sodium phosphate enemas? It's basically mixing water and salt. So a saline solution, pulling in water, making this stool easier to pass.
Sodium phosphate hypertonic enemas, so you'll commonly see these be referred to as Fleet enemas, but a lot of the Fleet enemas do have phosphate in them. They are effective and smaller volumes are often required, but I will say the Fleet phosphate enemas often cause electrolyte abnormalities. So a lot of my geriatric pharmacist friends really dislike the Fleet enemas because they can cause serious electrolyte abnormalities. So I try to avoid those in our older adults and then patients with kidney disease.
And just for a bit of background, the phosphate in the enemas are absorbed from the GI tract. However, in patients with kidney dysfunction or dehydration, this phosphate can overwhelm the body's ability to remove the excess phosphate. And this can cause high phosphate levels and low calcium levels.
Yeah. So if your patient has kidney disease with phosphates that are already elevated, maybe stay away from the Fleet or sodium phosphate enemas.
Another enema or suppository that works similarly are the glycerin suppositories.
Yeah. So glycerin enemas basically work by pulling in water into the colon to soften the stools.
And so can you guess how lactulose enemas work?
Yes. Probably the same mechanism, right? Lactulose, we already mentioned, is that synthetic disaccharide. So via osmosis, just like the PO version, right, will draw water into the colon.
So lactulose enemas, it's similar, but it's not as much as a tap water, but it's still a significant amount of liquid. And you can always tell whenever a lactulose enema is, there's a specific smell. If someone's on lactulose, you can walk on the floor and you could pick out the room in like a second. Especially if they're on a lactulose enema, it's like, yeah, you know, there's no question of it.
That is good to know. I feel like I do have like a smell that I smell from time to time. And I'm like, oh, that's C. diff, but maybe it was a lactulose enema all this time.
I think there are too many different smells in the hospital for me to be able to remember them all.
So true. That could be like a fun game for new conference.
Oh my God. So to recap.
Yeah, no, thank you. Yes, keep us on track.
So to recap so far, we have mineral oil enemas, which are well tolerated and basically lubricate the stool and walls of the colon to get things moving. And then there are all the enemas that work by pulling in water from the body into the colon to soften up the stool. These are the Fleet enemas, glycerin enemas, and lactulose enemas.
Yeah, and I really appreciate, again, learning the mechanism, because after thinking about what a patient might tolerate and worrisome side effects, then I think it's thinking about what are the different enemas and mechanisms that I can like pair together if someone's really clogged up with severe constipation.
Okay, we have one last group of enemas to close it out, the hypotonic enemas. These are like tap water and soap suds. Because these have a lower osmolarity compared to the surrounding tissues, water moves from the enema solution into the colon, and this increases stool volume and stimulates peristalsis. The soap sud enemas actually have an added mechanism in that they irritate the colon, and this also helps in stool evacuation.
Yeah, and maybe with that, we can recap some of the side effects we've talked about so far. So, for example, mineral oil enemas, it's not irritating, but maybe difficult for patients to hold in their rectum and may take a while than others to work. Tap water enemas are pretty well tolerated. And I think for the most part, I don't know if this is similar in your hospital, wherever you work. I feel like a lot of nurses like using tap water enemas and ask for them. Sodium phosphate enemas may be used in caution in elderly patients or people who already have kidney disease and high phosphate levels. And then, as you just mentioned, Kalila, soap sud enemas can cause colonic irritation to evacuate the stool, but anecdotally, it's generally well tolerated.
And one last thing, and I promise this is the last thing, let's hear from Jack about the nursing perspective on administering these enemas.
Fleet, or a mineral oil type enema, actually comes in a little like squirt bottle. And it has a little tip, and you put it in, and you just squeeze the whole bottle, and it goes in. With a tap water or soap suds, it looks almost like a two-feed bag. So you put it with warm water, you fill it up, you put it on an IV pole, and then same mechanism, you go into the rectum. The tricky part is having it stay in, because you're instilling about a liter of fluid sometimes into these patients, and depending on the patient's condition, this is more of a gown-up type situation a lot of the time, because it can go in and sometimes it just comes right back out and it becomes a mess very quickly. I can't stress it enough. Pre-planning this is like a big thing. If it ever gets ordered toward the end of shift or even at nighttime, it's probably not going to get done until the morning. Just because it is intensive a little bit, especially if you have someone who can't walk, is bedbound, they're hard to turn, they have a broken leg. There's all these things going on where this enema, it's just going to cause, it's going to be a mess. You're going to spend probably like 2 hours in these rooms with some of these patients just for the cleanup after.
Wow, that is really eye-opening for me. So many times I have just clicked the order button and it seems as though the medications are magically given to the patients. But we have so many blind spots about what our colleagues have to experience to give these medications at the bedside.
Yeah, right. Which is why I love doing this podcast and getting to learn from as many different perspectives as possible. It's just, I don't know, so awesome. And I wish we did that more. If you remember from Pearl 1, the P in the LM and OP mnemonic stood for pharmacologic causes of constipation. And one of the most notorious and unfortunately common one is opioid-induced constipation.
Okay, so let's think about how opioids can contribute to constipation. There's really two big ways. One is slowing down the GI tract, and two is impairing sphincter tone. And then on top of that, opioids also reduce biliary and pancreatic secretion, and this messes up digestion and drug absorption.
Ugh, I definitely don't think about the digestion and drug absorption bit. But say our patient really needs these opioids. We've maxed out on all other good things when it comes to multimodal pain regimens. What else can we do to prevent constipation?
There is a study that suggested that transdermal formulations of opioids actually had less incidence of opioid-induced constipation compared to oral administration of equivalent doses of morphine.
So I was definitely relieved to learn that there are some lateral moves we can make where we can change to other opioids that are less likely to cause constipation.
Yeah, transdermal patches. Oh, so good. I think I like typically reach for them with patients with cancer pain and things like that. But what's good to know this trick and maybe to reach out to pharmacy or pain service to help with the titration of a transdermal patch.
Another example would be tapentadol, which is a mixed opioid agonist, as well as a norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. There is some data to suggest that it may have less GI side effects compared to traditional opioids.
All right, so we have transdermal patches, tapentadol. What about if those are not an option? What else could we do for opioid-induced constipation?
And then I think in patients who are still struggling despite some of these pragmatic changes, then we have a specific algorithm for opioid-induced constipation. So typically we'll use our traditional over-the-counter laxatives, so things like osmotic laxatives, stimulant laxatives, et cetera. And then if patients fail two of these types of laxatives, then we start thinking about prescription laxatives, specifically these PAMORAs, which are these peripherally acting mu opioid receptor antagonists. And so these are medications that block the actions of opioids in the gut specifically, but they don't cross into the central nervous system, and so they don't affect pain management.
So Dr. Lee here is describing PAMs or PAMORAs, the most common being methyl naltrexone, which actually comes both in oral and subcutaneous injections.
And these work better for people that have been on opioids for at least 4 weeks. So patients treated with opioids for less than 4 weeks might actually have less of a response to our mu opioid antagonists. And it's recommended to actually stop treatment with our other maintenance laxatives prior to starting the opioid antagonist. And then if they don't get relief from the opioid antagonist, we can reinitiate our other therapies.
One thing I do have to reassure my patients about is that methyl naltrexone does not affect the pain relief that they're going to feel from the opioids.
Yeah, what a great drug. So methyl naltrexone basically targets the gut, which is the area of concern when it comes to constipation, but still maintains the systemic effects of the opioids, particularly with pain relief. So I guess with that, how effective is methyl naltrexone in terms of relieving the constipation?
It's actually really effective. And methyl naltrexone is dose dependent. So if you give a patient 1 milligram of methyl naltrexone, on average, there will be relief in around 48 hours. But if you give them 5 milligrams or greater, there's relief in a whopping 1.26 hours.
So what's the catch?
I think these PAMORAs certainly have a pretty high rate of side effects. So depending on the literature, it's like 15 to 30% of patients will have adverse side effects. Abdominal pain is typically the most common side effect from these PAMORAs, but diarrhea is definitely up there. So yes, that is a negative or potential downside with these PAMORAs.
Oh man, it is humbling to hear that these medications for constipation may make things like abdominal pain worse, which, you know, our patients may already be feeling from their constipation.
Yeah, so much to think about when dealing with constipation and this abdominal pain. So let's do a quick recap. The peripheral mu receptor antagonists, or PAMORAs, like methyl naltrexone, are medications that can be used for opioid-induced constipation in patients who have failed a typical laxative trial.
And then the utility of methyl naltrexone is really targeting the action of the opioids on the gut without decreasing the opioid systemic effects, particularly on pain relief.
Some side effects of the medication includes abdominal pain and diarrhea. So if your patient is not able to tolerate a PAMORA, consider alternative medications like transdermal patches.
And that is it for today. Thank you so much for listening. If you got some value from this podcast, please, please, please share it with at least one other colleague who might also get something from the episode.
And thank you so much to our reviewers for this podcast. Thank you to Dr. Jesse Powell for the accompanying graphics. This episode was made as part of the digital education track at BIDMC.
Opinions expressed are our own and do not represent the opinions of any affiliated institutions. Thank you and take care.